Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd. I just got off the Meet the Press set and wrapped up interviews with the Austrian Chancellor Karl Nehammer, the White House COVID coordinator Dr. Ashish Jain, retiring Republican Congressman Fred Upton. Sitting here now with my longtime friend Ruth Marcus. She's the deputy editorial page editor for the Washington Post. Ruth, what a week.
It was a week with lots, as we were talking about, lots of different things going on. Not one dominant story, but a lot of stories.
Right. And it is sort of this, you know, with the war, and I'm sure you get this, you're an editorial leader in the newsroom. It's like, well, what's the top story? Well, it's the war, you know, and then it's like, okay, what's the next story? And it's hard not to lead with the war.
And you know, it's really fascinating because we are going to have this war with us. It is now clear for months, if not years, to come.
It sort of feels like what happened in Central Europe when, you know, in the early and mid 90s, that suddenly, that was a couple of, people forget that. We didn't just, you know, by the time we came in, it ended it fast, but it was going on for a while.
And so then how do you, as a news organization, as an opinion section, how do you cover it? You have a moral responsibility not to forget it, but you also have a responsibility to your readers and your viewers to think about different stories and different arguments to make to them. And so I think it's a real challenge for us.
I began my week podcasting with Ron Klain, and he said, breaking through the Ukraine story, he said, and he wasn't trying to be critical of the press. He's like, I get it. There's only such amount of bandwidth. But he seemed to indicate it's made their messaging challenge even harder.
They don't
have it easy anyway.
Yeah, I was going to say, made their already difficult messaging challenge even harder. I mean, there's something that I was hoping we would get to talk about, and so I'm glad to have a chance to talk about it here. One of the things that's really fascinating is that Ukraine, and I'm sensitive about saying this, but it should be a little bit of a good news messaging story. I mean, it's a horrific catastrophe for Ukraine.
But that freedom fighters are winning?
But not just that freedom fighters are winning, but that the Biden administration, from my point of view, has done a very good job of handling the Ukraine crisis. It has rallied the alliance. It has repaired a lot of the damage that President Trump created. It has, I mean, you could have arguments about whether this set of artillery got to Ukraine right quickly enough, but the reality is Biden has done and then not done most of what the United States wanted, the United States electorate wanted. It has given Ukraine a lot of military weaponry, and it has taken efforts not to put U.S. troops at risk. And yet, in the poll that we were talking about, only 40% approval, just a little bit above his overall approval rating for Biden's handling of Ukraine. And that just underscores to me the challenge that he has. Most of the country approves of what he did, but they don't approve that he did it. Not most, but 40%.
You know,
most doesn't approve.
Haley Barbour had this, you know, back in the 90s, there were a lot of Haley Barbourisms that we all used to enjoy. One of them was, good gets great and bad gets worse. And this one for Biden, it feels like he is, I've said, he's like Velcro to negative headlines, you know, and everything is sticking to him negatively. I have been waiting to see him get a bump out of Ukraine, and it's not there.
Well, that, because is a bump available in our current environment?
It's interesting. Well, the bump would have to come from his own base, because that's what, I've had this theory though. I think what we're watching is, this is, if you look at the 3 one-term presidents you and I have covered, they did all have one thing in common, which was divided parties. Trump's party was clearly divided. George H.W. Bush's version of, he was leading a divided party, and Jimmy Carter was leading a divided party. Biden feels like a guy also leading a divided party, and the energy is not on his side.
The energy isn't on his side, and the country has actually really changed to make his job so much more difficult, I think, than George H.W. Bush's or Jimmy Carter had a very hard job and had a very hard economic circumstance.
But similar, it's scary how similar the circumstances are. I mean, you know, I remember a lot of people did describe to me 2020 as 76, meaning it was an election about getting rid of the other guy and looking for stability and somebody you felt morally comfortable with, right? In that sense, Carter, Biden, these are just good people. And then they inherit this inflation thing that wasn't, they didn't do any. You could say they did some things that made it, short term made it worse, but it's not much they can do.
There was another number that really jumped out at me in the poll, which is relevant to this conversation, which is 61% feel pessimistic about the economic situation now and pessimistic in the future.
Yeah.
That's up from 37% a year ago.
It's never been easier to get a job.
Yes, it's never been easier to get a job. If you are, if you're graduating from college right now and you've made it through COVID, mm-hmm. your job prospects are really good. And as Amna was saying at the on the show, and you're really depressed because how am I ever going to afford a house? How am I ever going to afford a mortgage? But, you know, Biden creates a little bit of a problem for himself, I think, when he talks about the economy and he talks about, I created all these jobs. He talks about, I created this low unemployment rate. I cut the deficit. Well, if you're owning that, then you got to own inflation, too. The truth is that you're probably not responsible for either one, or not primarily responsible for either one. But, you know, if you claim it, you own it.
Can you find me the elected official that will run on a platform of the following to deal with inflation? More immigrants. Can we slow down wage growth, raise taxes, and raise interest rates to make buying a house harder?
No, I can't. Thank you very much.
Right. This is what makes it, like, the actual solution is politically totally toxic.
Totally toxic. And look at the immigration debate we're about to have.
It's worse.
I mean, the immigration debate that we should be having is exactly the one that you suggest. We need more legal immigration into this country. There is no way we can have the job force that we need and the economy that we deserve and should be able to have if we do not have people to fill these jobs.
Our economy, the most uncomfortable fact about our economic success is the fact that that immigrants have been our low-wage workers. They've been our low-wage workers since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, if you wanted it. And we can become Japan, or we can continue to do this. And it's, again, you have people, when I've talked about this issue, I've had, so are you saying you want foreign jobs and not American? And you're just sitting there going, you don't understand how the American economy's worked for 100 years.
But is the inability, maybe you have a better explanation for this than I do, the inability of the sort of basic economics of the positive force that immigration could be, the inability of that to break through the populace, to have people understand that immigrants, if we let them in, if we let in, you know, let, you know, staple the high-tech workers, you know, to their diplomas, staple the visa to their diplomas. Why is that so hard to grasp? And contrarily, and I know you're supposed to be asking the questions, Chuck, so sorry.
No.
Why is the argument that immigrants are going to take your jobs so powerful when it's not true?
It's obvious.
For the most part.
Look, you can't separate out the race issue from this. We know this. I mean, why is Maggie Hassan, a senator from New Hampshire, going to not the Canadian border, but the Mexican border, right? It's because with that white population, this penetrates. The whiter your working class population is in your state, the more potent the immigration issue is. Mandela Barnes, the lieutenant governor of Wisconsin, I think most people would say he's a progressive. He came out and said, oh, Title 42, not touching it.
Michael Bennett.
Yeah. They are reacting to their electorates here. The fact of the matter is, Donald Trump is winning the conversation about immigration. It's nobody has figured out a better counter yet.
I agree, and I have not figured out what the Biden administration is supposed to do with the Title 42 mess that it has. There is no longer, there probably has not been for some time, mm-hmm. a health justification for keeping people out,
right.
And it is entirely foreseeable and obvious that therefore a ton of people who are desperate, mostly economic migrants, right. are going to try to enter. Entirely foreseeable that the Biden administration will be blamed for this. I don't know what a responsible administration is supposed to do.
Well, I'll quote Henry Cuellar, because I asked him, what do you want to see? And he said, just surge asylum judges to the border. Do them there at the border. That didn't seem like an unreasonable idea, which is, you know, don't wait for them to come into the country. See if you can create a system at the border. But it's not like you can flip the switch.
You can't create asylum judges.
You know, he suggested doing asylum, put asylum judges in Honduras and actually doing it in country, in Guatemala, in Honduras, in the places that we're seeing the most come. I don't know if that's the best idea, but it seems like a solution that you could get bipartisan support for, maybe. Yeah, you're skeptical.
There, what is the partisan motive to support a sensible outcome?
Well, that's the problem, the reward structure. Yeah. Look, this gets at whether it's the Fred Upton conversation I have. I mean, this is our biggest problem is compromise is considered a loss now, not a win.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised Fred Upton because I thought that was a fascinating conversation. And I was really glad to hear from him. I was watching last night as I was preparing his really powerful floor speech. And and in particular, I was struck by the fact that the first person that he called to let her know, the first lawmaker he called to let her know about his decision to retire, it wasn't his leader of his party. It was Debbie Dingell, his friend and colleague. That is, you know, from
Fred
another.
Fred Upton and John Dingell, her late husband, were very close.
Yes. Yeah, right? This is, and, you know, she was in tears over this, as was he. This is a moment from another time. I was trying to think through his argument that the smaller the majority Republicans seem destined to have, the worse the situation is going to be in terms of getting some decent, sensible, as he would say, because he's a member of that caucus, problem solver outcome. I can actually see the argument that they're screwed either way, that there is difficulty because the greater the Republican.
Well, it depends who you sweep in.
Yeah.
Right. I think what he's hoping is if it's a bigger majority, you're going to sweep in
more sane people.
Some Republicans that win some swing districts who had to run and being, hey, I'm not. I always say you can actually tell the people that are not Trumpy, but they don't want to say they're not Trumpy. You know, if you're Trumpy, you say America first. You say you a lot of times if you're actually not Trumpy, you'll say, and I support President Trump's policies, you know, or something like that. You see these distinctions out there. They don't want to alienate the base, but it's an interesting little middle ground. So I buy the idea that, okay, if, you know, the Republicans that could get swept in a New Jersey or in a California, they're going to possibly be Fred Upton-like or Don Bacon-like.
That would be nice. And so if a bigger Republican majority offers more opportunity for sanity, so be it.
The interesting thing is what he said about, and I've heard this from everybody in McCarthy, is the smaller the majority, how does he find the 218? How does he get to the number he needs to be speaker?
Yeah. And if not him, who?
Well, I've put my money on, I think, Stefanik or Scalise. I actually think they're both in a better position to, in some ways, they're in the perfect catbird seat. They're not challenging him. It's sort of like, you prove, it's almost like you, when we see in parliamentary elections, okay, you try to form the coalition. Okay, now it's your turn to form the coalition.
And are they going to be better at herding those cats?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I look, I'm with you. I don't buy it either. But it is funny how the Overton window changes, because there was a time that some of these Republicans that are the pragmatists were considered very conservative. Think of a Pat Toomey.
Yeah.
So these things do seem to change. Good Passover?
Excellent Passover. Actually, so our first pandemic Passover with my family, we did it by Zoom.
Yeah.
The kids were home with their significant others, but my mom was on Zoom and the TV.
You really did it for your mom. Well, was that the Seder was for really for mom?
No, it was for everybody. My brother was on Zoom. My mom was on Zoom. My kids were home. That was the best that we could do. The second Passover that we had was outside on the screen porch, and we were kind of distanced at different tables.
Yeah.
And this was the first Passover, and we all tested before we came.
Oh, wow. So you really...
But this was the first Passover that we were all together.
Well, you did it the same way we did it. We did a little bit of Zoom, and we did an outdoor one last year, semi-outdoor, undercover, in case it rained.
Yes, except my girls didn't come home, I have to say, with some degree of sadness.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was a little sad.
When do they stop coming? My daughter leaves for college in August.
Well, they start coming back.
Yeah.
But if they're good children, they come.
They should come for every one of these.
Passover.
Yeah, I mean, do you get at least every other Passover?
Yeah, well, no. Well, some had better excuses than others. One is studying for her law school exams.
All right.
And I'm not mentioning her sister.
Okay, ouch. favorite Passover food, and What do you hate the most about the Seder food?
Well, my favorite Passover food has to be chocolate matzah.
They didn't have this when I was growing up. Where was the chocolate matzah? And my kids, that's all they think matzah is only it's has like, chocolate on it.
We call it matzah crack.
It is.
And in our house, we can't stop eating it. I didn't make any this year, though I did make a lovely orange almond cake.
Oh, you made, I'd like you, to say. You will make your own chocolate matzah?
Yeah. Yeah. Come over. I'll show you how to do it.
I'm not that committed. And what's your least favorite?
Oh, it's all good. But I like to say, identify with everybody who did not grow up eating gefilte fish, not eating gefilte fish, because it's not an acquired taste.
No, it's not.
It's an important taste.
I insist on my friend Steve Rabinowitz. I went to a Seder that he did once, and he actually had edible gefilte fish.
Yeah,
and
no, said, there's ways to cook it.
And I said, how did
better.
You do it? And so he buys it as a loaf.
Yeah.
And then bakes it with tomato sauce on it.
Or you.
And then chill it again. And that's what I've copied that. It makes it edible. My kids still won't eat it, but at least I had fewer plates where, you know how people take the no thank you bite?
Yeah.
I threw away less gefilte fish this year.
That's how I knew one of my kids' significant others was like, could join the family when he took more than the one.
Oh, no, he took more than the one. Yes. He took more than one. And let me see if he really
liked
her.
He's a keeper.
Yeah, I was just going to say. Well, enjoy the rest of the week.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.